Hello, everyone. My name is Tara Earle, and I work at ICF International in Atlanta, Georgia. We are also a public health research and evaluation consulting firm. And I'm presenting today along with my colleague, Margie Snyder, who's at Purdue University in Indiana. So I'm going to present about the Collaborative Practice Agreement Case Studies Project. And before I go any further, I'd like to acknowledge individuals who I want to first state that this is a project that was funded by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, particularly the Division of Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention, the Applied Research and Evaluation Branch. There are other colleagues here who are part of this project that are not here today. I just want to briefly acknowledge them. Diane Mattson-Kaufman of the CDC, Siobhan Gilchrist, who also works as a contractor to the CDC, as well as my colleagues at ICF, Michael Greenberg, Holly Heisler, and Michelle Rebels. We also worked in collaboration with the American Pharmacists Association Foundation, and our colleagues also mentioned here, and this work would not have been possible were we not able to work with our participants and our partners on the case studies. So just to give you an overview, we're going to talk a little bit about the purpose of the project, give you some background about the project, our methodology, talk about the case study sites, as well as some findings, lessons learned, and considerations for the future practice for those who are interested in this type of work. I just want to give a little context about the project. So the CDC was interested in several initiatives that talk about expanding the role of pharmacists. There were, in addition to looking at, for instance, how the practices were defined, the policy is defined overall, the purpose of our project was to identify three sites where we can do like a deep dive and really understand through a case study methodology how collaborative practice agreements, in particular collaborative drug therapy management, were being implemented. So really, the goal was to understand how these services, these practices were being implemented in terms of improving chronic disease management and improving patient health outcomes. I'm going to turn this part of the presentation over to Margie because she is a pharmacist and she can talk a little bit more about the background and give you a broader sense.
Thank you, Tara. And good afternoon. Thank you guys for sticking around for the last presentation. We appreciate that. So as Tara said, you might be asking the question, well, why pharmacists? Why is there this emphasis on pharmacist-prescriber collaborations? Well, as she had mentioned, this has been a focus area for the Centers for Disease Control, and this was one part of several initiatives that they're doing focused on looking at opportunities for expanding the role of pharmacists in the community. And there's also two recent reports that we wanted to highlight and just call to your attention in case you're interested in looking at them for further reading. One of them is the Chisholm and Burns article that's there on the slide. That's a systematic review that was published recently looking at the impact that pharmacists as members on the healthcare team have. You can see that quote there that comes from that report that incorporating pharmacists as healthcare team members in direct patient care has favorable effects across various patient outcomes, healthcare settings, and disease states. The other report that I wanted to call to your attention is a Surgeon General report that was published in December of 2011. And essentially, this Surgeon General report served as a call to action. It cited a lot of literature that exists looking at the incorporation of pharmacists into healthcare teams. And again, was a call to action that there is a need for pharmacists to be formally recognized in the Social Security Act as healthcare providers and really become a member, essential member of the healthcare team. So there's many avenues by which pharmacists can collaborate with prescribers. So I wanted to briefly touch on a couple of those in order to compare and contrast and help you to further understand the differences and what exactly it is that we're talking about when we refer to collaborative drug therapy management, as Tara had mentioned. So one of the more common and increasingly common strategies by which pharmacists and physicians can collaborate is what's called medication therapy management. That term was actually introduced through Medicare Part D when it was launched in 2006. And essentially, when we talk about medication therapy management, or MTM, What we're referring to is a service by which pharmacists meet with eligible patients by appointment, conduct an in-depth medication review, and then develop both patient-centered documents for that patient and their caregiver to use in order to better manage their medications, but also to then collaborate with that physician by offering drug therapy recommendations. That then places the physician in the role to then have the opportunity to either accept or not accept, for whatever reason, those drug therapy recommendations and implement those in the patient's regimen. So collaborative practice agreements and then collaborative drug therapy management essentially take that relationship a step further. And then in this model, there's actually a formal agreement that exists between the pharmacist and the collaborating physician that outlines specific ways in which that physician can then delegate certain patient care tasks to the pharmacist, who will perform those tasks under the supervision of that physician. The type of tasks, as you can see, are highlighted under our bullets with regards to collaborative drug therapy management. So, for example, the pharmacist could perform patient assessments, order laboratory tests related to medication monitoring, administer drugs, select, initiate, discontinue, monitor drugs, etc. So in terms of comparing and contrasting those two models, essentially what that means is if a pharmacist was to perform a comprehensive medication review for a patient and identify that that patient could benefit from the addition of an additional antihypertensive agent, just as an example, in the medication therapy management model, the pharmacist would make that recommendation and communicate that recommendation to the provider, and then it would be up to them to make a decision about whether to implement that. And the contrast of that is in a collaborative drug therapy management environment, if that agent was part of that protocol that was agreed upon by that pharmacist and that physician, then they could go ahead and implement that new therapy on that patient's regimen. As you can see, the laws that permit collaborative drug therapy management between pharmacists and physicians do vary by the state that they practice in. And you can look at state practice acts and also for pharmacists and also for physicians in some cases. And that spells out what's allowed specifically in that state. From this map, you can see that across the U.S., almost every state has language that permits collaborative drug therapy management, at least to some extent, between pharmacists and physicians. And there are special cases where you can see it's limited by practice setting, specifically what the pharmacist can do. So that takes us to what questions guided this case studies project. The first question really focuses more on policy enactment. You can see again, as I indicated, across the U.S., most states do have policies on the books, if you will, that allow these arrangements to exist between pharmacists and physicians. However, it's not ubiquitous, and there are differences across the states. So our first question was really looking at what are the strategies, barriers, and facilitators to enacting policies that permit collaborative drug therapy management. And then our second question, which is really what's going to be the focus of the rest of our presentation, is what are the strategies, barriers, and facilitators to implementing collaborative drug therapy management policies? And that's what we're going to spend the rest of our time this afternoon talking about. So I'm going to turn it back over to Tara, and she's going to go into depth a little bit about the methods that we used in this case studies project.
And so as I mentioned before, the goal here was to do more of a deep dive and understand what was going on the ground. For others who are interested in this type of work, we were particularly interested in identifying three sites that had different approaches to how they implemented these type of policies. In particular, we had some selection criteria that we wanted to make sure the three sites had in common. For example, duration, scope, and reach. Under duration, if you're thinking about that, we wanted to find a site that we would call or characterize as being extensively experienced. This is a site that had been in existence for 5 years or more. These are the folks that we could learn from, that we can understand the things they challenge and how they overcame things in terms of implementation. Then we wanted to look at sites that were characterized as newly implemented, less than 5 years, still getting off the ground. For others who were just in that position, how could they learn from them who are just starting out? Under scope, we were interested in folks that were implementing limited aspects of CDTM. These are people who had brought into the philosophy of CDTM, but they had not yet fully implemented all aspects of it. So we wanted to learn from that type of setting as well. In addition, reach. We have to have at least one site that would give us some insight about this potential to have the potential to have this impact on a large, diverse population. And so by that, you would characterize that as like a regional pharmacy chain. And I also want to say that this project was a 12-month project. And so when we were identifying these three sites, based on the map that we just showed you, the sites are in states that are highlighted in a darker text. So El Rio Community Center in Tucson, Arizona is the FQHC. They were identified as being extensively experienced. They've been doing this work for many years and offered a lot of insight that we'll talk about a little bit later. As well as Osterhaus Pharmacy is the independent pharmacy in Maquoketa, Iowa. And if I said that wrong, forgive me. They were characterized as being limited and also extensively experienced. And then Car Drug, which is a regional pharmacy chain in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, was characterized as being limited, newly implemented, and a retail pharmacy chain that would offer us the range. So in terms of the selection, we identified and contacted 10 sites. But through various reasons that ranged from either not being returning our calls or being able to reach them, or some sites had challenges in actually implementing CDTM, we were able to identify these three for this site. We'll talk a little bit more about the barriers that people face when we get to the section a little later in the presentation, but I also wanted to just highlight that. Margie, you want to talk a little bit more? So I want to identify Margie is a worked with us at ICF. She led the team that was on the ground doing a lot of the case studies. So I'm going to turn it over to her to talk a little bit more about the findings.
So again, as a reminder, what we're going to talk about is really focusing on that implementation question rather than the enactment piece. So on this slide, what we wanted to do was highlight the different elements that are really a part of what we would consider a comprehensive model of collaborative drug therapy management. So again, you can see on the left there some of those elements, such as performing patient assessments, ordering laboratory tests, administering drugs, monitoring and continuing drug regimens, and then selecting, initiating, and adjusting drug regimens. And as Tara mentioned, what we really wanted to get with these case studies was that variety, so we could see different strategies by which collaborative drug therapy management and elements of CDTM were initiated in different community-based settings. So you can see across the sites then, we saw some variation. With El Rio, this was a site that we had visited again because it's extensively experienced, and what we found was that they were offering a more comprehensive model for collaborative drug therapy management. And at this site, it was really focused around delivering care for patients with diabetes, and the drug therapy management protocols that existed between pharmacists and physicians at that site were primarily around diabetes and associated comorbidities. At the Car Drug site, it was a little bit different. Here you can see that at this site, they'd implemented elements of collaborative drug therapy management as part of a feasibility study, looking at the pharmacogenetic testing and adjustment of medications for an antiplatelet agent. And in this case, the collaborative drug therapy management agreements were formed in order to allow the pharmacist to order laboratory tests in order to identify that patient's genetic profile for that medication and how they might respond to that medication. However, when the pharmacist received that information, they then made drug therapy recommendations back to the patient's physicians. And so again, that was more of a recommendation-based approach for those changes that might be made to the medications. So that drug therapy management agreement that existed was really for the laboratory testing piece of it. And then the final case study site was Osterhaus Pharmacy. And in this case study was also a little bit different. And here, the collaborative drug therapy management elements were really centered around two different protocols that exist. One was a medication substitution protocol. So that was an agreement that was put into place between the pharmacist at the pharmacy and a nearby physician office, looking at things like ways to improve medication adherence among patients. So if there was a drug prescribed and the patient wasn't able to swallow it, for example, if it was a larger tablet, then there were some agreements there where a different dosage form could be used. Or if it wasn't the preferred agent through the patient's insurance company, that switch could be made. So it was more limited in terms of its scope. There was also an immunization protocol so that pharmacists could immunize patients against influenza under protocol with the collaborating physician. So you can see that variation in what we saw across the sites. So next, we wanted to highlight some of the key barriers that we saw and some of the ways in which the sites were similar and different in terms of the barriers that were identified. Something to note, both for this slide and also the next slide about facilitators, is that although we do break it down by case study site, it is important to know that that meant that they were particularly emphasized at that site. It doesn't mean, though, that it didn't exist. It's just what really came out as we had conversations with folks. So just because it's not X'd off somewhere doesn't necessarily mean it wasn't there at all. So one of the barriers, though, that came out commonly across all of the sites was a lack of a sustainable reimbursement mechanism for the collaborative drug therapy management services themselves. For the most part, these services were being paid for by grants, so it wasn't a sustainable compensation mechanism. All of the sites also mentioned that there was initially some hesitation among physicians and other providers to trust the pharmacist with this expanded role, and that it took some time to develop those relationships and have these services then be continued and be into place. Finally, they also all commented on there being a lack of time and resources available for doing things like developing the agreements themselves. And in North Carolina, where it actually requires the pharmacist who engages in these agreements to have another credential to go through that paperwork to get that credential. So those were some common challenges there. Another, and I will mention one more because it's kind of interesting, and you'll see it in both perspectives as a barrier and a facilitator, and that's that informal collaboration. So we said there's a lot of ways that pharmacists can work with physicians, and so some of the groups that were engaged in a lot of medication therapy management commented that it was actually almost a barrier for them then to go on and do collaborative drug therapy management because they found such high success with this informal collaboration, and there was so much paperwork and things that had to be completed in order to make that relationship more formalized. So looking at facilitators then, you can see some of the things that worked across the board for these sites and that they reported to us were having stakeholder buy-in. So again, having those champions that have been mentioned by other speakers. Also working with student pharmacists and other learners such as pharmacy residents at their sites. So by having these learners see patients, that was again having more opportunities for that site to be highlighted and put in front of the physicians for them to get to know each other a little bit better and understand further what pharmacists can do. And you can see also simply having pharmacists that were adequately trained and be able to have the confidence to provide these services. So in wrapping up with lessons learned and then stepping into a little bit with limitations and finally some considerations moving forward, with regards to lessons learned, some of the things that we've mentioned here. So it is important to develop trust and to spend the time to do networking between the pharmacists and physicians. They can get to know each other a little bit better, particularly if the physicians and pharmacists are practicing off-site from each other. So this was less of a challenge at the El Rio site where they're practicing in the same facility. Also, using those learners that you have at your practice. We also found, again, that the participants told us that these informal collaborations are important, whether it be perceived as a facilitator because then the physicians were used to working with pharmacists and potentially more interested in going into formalizing that relationship, or as a barrier in the ways that I talked about, that they're important. Again, compensation also varied by setting and was an ongoing barrier across the sites. So briefly, with regards to the limitations of this study, there was a small number of case studies that we completed. We were only going to be able to complete three, as we highlighted, and we were only able to interview a small number of key informants at each of the sites. So it is unknown, although our goal wasn't really so much that transferability, but it was more of that in-depth, deep dive, as Tara had mentioned. It could limit our transferability because we don't know if we had gone to more sites and interviewed more participants if we had found further themes. Due to some logistical barriers, we weren't able to visit one of the sites face-to-face, although we did go out and see the others. So again, that might have just impacted what we were able to find from that site. And finally, due to budget resources, budget constraints, we audio recorded our interviews, conducted debriefing among our site visitors, but there wasn't a formal data coding process that was utilized. So that might have also limited, and we might have found additional themes had we been able to do so. So with regards to moving forward, if there's anyone thinking about implementing collaborative drug therapy management, some things to consider. One of the things we found from this case study is that expansion of pharmacist roles through various models of CDTM is possible and does exist, and it does vary in terms of how they're implemented. However, to further maximize expansion, what we found and what the recommendations were is that, again, compensation models were a challenge, and so that legal recognition of pharmacists and healthcare providers with associated compensation models would be important moving forward. And that's all we have. Thank you.
Thank you. That was an excellent set of talks. Do we have any questions? I have go ahead.
Does the formal recognition of pharmacists and healthcare providers through the Social Security Act require legislation, or could that be done through an administrative rule?
Just for the question is, you know, how exactly does that happen for pharmacists to be recognized as providers in the Social Security Act? So that is an act of Congress that would actually have to happen. And there's been various conversations around that for many, many years in different groups within the pharmacy profession that have worked to try to introduce legislature and also just sort of lobby around that point. But it is an ongoing conversation, and it is something that would require significant changes there. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
Can you speak a little bit more about the compensation structure that maybe some of your sites were recommending or desiring, and if that requires some kind of formal structure, or if, like you were saying, if an informal relationship is important,
Yeah, so the question is with regards to the compensation structure in terms of what exists and what could be an option moving forward. Does that kind of get at your question? One of the challenges is that currently in Medicare, the only ways in which a pharmacist can directly bill for services rather than products is through Medicare Part D for medication therapy management services. So that is a Part D benefit rather than Part B. So in order for pharmacists to bill directly through Part B for their services, that's where we're talking about with the change in the Social Security Act to recognize them as providers. So that's why the billing is tied to that. And then commercial plans generally will follow what Medicare does. So currently, there are different ways, and I'm certainly not an expert in this, where indirect billing can sometimes occur where a pharmacist is billing under the license of a physician in a supervised setting, and that's more for a low-level type of service, and so it doesn't really reflect oftentimes the service that's being provided and the time and the expertise of that provider. So there's some limitations there in terms of the revenue that can be generated. So in terms of a steady revenue stream, it often doesn't necessarily make sense. And the other things that we were hearing is that, you know, it's also, you know, that would be an option moving forward, but that currently, again, it's a lot of grant funding and it's sort of piecemeal, and it's not really that sustainable compensation mechanism to date, and that's been part of the challenge. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. Additional questions? I have a few. Chenira. What would you have done differently if you had had another chance to conduct this or a similar campaign? And did you have any negative feedback or pushback regarding the campaign, and how did you address that? You were talking about disseminating best practices across.
Okay, yeah. So basically in terms of just, you know, things that we would do differently, one is, you know, I had mentioned a campaign website that we had, and I think we could have leveraged it a lot more than what we did to really help with even reaching the long-term care facilities that I mentioned was a challenge and group to reach. And then the other thing, too, is maybe as a state health department and other partners to really play a more active role in helping to sort of make more visible within the healthcare facilities the campaign. So although we know that we definitely engage the point persons at each facility and the CDI prevention teams, but really helping them to provide them with, say, campaign materials and resources that they could also use to engage the other groups within the facilities that were not that as directly involved in the CDI prevention efforts. And I think that we also really definitely saw the hesitation on the part of long-term care facilities in terms of just wondering, you know, what we're doing as a state health department and if they sort of shared some of their challenges with regards to their prevention practices, that perhaps we would take action from a more regulatory standpoint. So those are more in terms of, a little bit of the negative or more challenging aspect.
I have a follow-up question on that. Two questions. And congratulations on your discussion.
Thank you.
The first question is, how did you decide to focus on long-term care and acute care hospitals themselves? And secondly, since this is related to in-the-bad use, in-the-bad overuse, and long-term use, are there any plans to
go
further back in prevention and maybe touch the primary care providers or community pharmacies that
depends on
your
question? You just need to paraphrase the question and repeat it to the mic.
Okay, thank you. Right, so the question was why did we decide to target the healthcare facilities that we did? And then secondly, also in terms of looking at antibiotic use, which is a main contributor to C. diff infections. So our choice for in terms of healthcare facilities is we, because of the public reporting, we do a lot of public reporting on different healthcare-associated infections, so we just kind of had a long history of working with our acute care hospitals, and we really hadn't engaged them in a sort of a statewide level in infection prevention activities. So we wanted to continue definitely working with that group, and also, you know, a lot in terms of the literature, a lot is known about CDI prevention in acute care hospitals, so that really made sense. But then also, you know, patients transfer a lot between different facility types. In Illinois, we have several hundreds of different long-term care facilities, and so we thought that it made sense to begin also engaging that group and then moving forward to some other entities. And then in terms of antibiotic use, certainly it is, a very important component of CDI prevention, and that's why we are doing more now to look at addressing antibiotic use. Like I mentioned, starting with a small segment of, we actually did an antimicrobial stewardship collaborative last year with 10 acute care hospitals, and then this year we're picking a different set of 10 hospitals and working with them on that. But then in terms of sort of the long-term care facilities and looking at that, our current assessment that we're doing of the long-term care facilities really is showing us some very interesting results and sort of like helping us to better understand the drivers of antibiotic prescribing practices within this setting. And so we're hoping to have that inform our next steps in terms of how we really sort of target this issue within a long-term care, whether that's going to be another education campaign or something a little bit more different. But we definitely want to make sure that it's tailored to what would be effective.
Any other questions? I have a question. Christine, I was wondering if you could please describe a specific example of a strategic partnership that an IPP service provides that might be formed in this challenging healthcare environment.
Yeah. So going back to thinking about the strategic advantage that these providers offer and the gaps in the field, a lot of providers found opportunities around billing and reimbursement because they've historically offered free or donation services only. They didn't necessarily develop these capacities. And so a lot of the providers did an assessment to determine whether developing these are feasible or cost effective, and if the answer was no, then one option would be for them to partner with an FQHC. So the FQHC could provide the billing and reimbursement experience, and they would provide the STD and sexual reproductive health experience. So that could be one example of a very symbiotic relationship.
Thank you. I had a question also for Susan. That's a really tough project to try to get people to give up their lunches. were you just looking at organizations that actually had made change, and then did you look at organizations where maybe somebody had tried to make a change and it had just not worked out? Or did you say that and I didn't miss that? You know, I might have missed that part, because I can think of many ways that people would try to sabotage something like that.
So yes, it is hard to take food away from people. you know, it doesn't make anybody popular. So we, in the data that I described today, so that was the first step in our project. So that was when we were looking at what we call leaders. So organizations that had done these things and had successfully done these things. So there may be organizations that had attempted to do these things and failed, and so they wouldn't end up in our sample. So we're currently engaged in a second round of investigations, and we're traveling the country talking to institutions that we call laggards. Okay, so they have not done these things, or maybe they've done a little bit, but not very much. And we're trying to learn from them what's getting in their way. Because, you know, when I started looking at these things a number of years ago, nobody was really talking about this stuff. But now the AAMC, the Association of American Medical Colleges, has issued a set of recommendations that include banning gifts and having a central repository for drug samples and many of the things that we looked for in the leaders. The NIH has issued, or PHS has issued, recommendations and requirements about the kinds of conflicts of interest policies that it wants to see among institutions that get funding. So that happened last year. So there's much more pressure now than there ever has been before. So we're wondering, for the institutions that are laggards, what's going on? What's with that? You know, why? What's getting in their way? And what? How can we help them move forward? So those are the kinds of things that we're going to be looking at. And honestly, a lot of it is, so far what we're thinking is a lot of it is sort of inertia. A lack of commitment by leadership, you know, so they're thinking, oh, this is going to blow over, this is, you know, they don't really care that much, this isn't a thing that they think about or think is that important, and they think that this attention to conflict of interest is going to pass. I happen to think they are wrong about that. With the Sunshine Act coming next summer, we're going to have incredible amounts of new data. We will know almost to the penny every interaction between a drug company and a physician. So we are going to have more information than ever before about the kind and quality and, you know, financial amount of relationships that are going on between at least physicians and drug companies. So I think it's just going, the pressure's just going to increase. But right now, there's still inertia that hasn't happened yet. We don't have that information yet. And then I also think resources are big, because when you take somebody's lunch away, they get really angry, and you know, you've got to figure out how to replace that lunch, or, you know, get an express line in the cafeteria so that with the 5 minutes that they have available to eat, they can get in and out. So it's a commitment. It's a big commitment to make these changes. So I think there are many obstacles, and we'll be exploring what they are and how institutions could get around them.
Thank you. Anybody have another follow-up question on that one? I had one last question for Tara and Margie. You touched on some of the legislative barriers to the collaboration between pharmacists and primary care providers, and I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit more about what are the most important steps that need to take place next for increased collaboration between pharmacists and providers, such as in the collaborative drug therapy management.
Yeah, with
regards to next steps, I mean, I think a lot of it is what we've touched on. You know, I think we need to continue to explore opportunities for that legislation to happen, and also to look at opportunities for pharmacists to play a role in some of the new models for healthcare delivery in terms of accountable care organizations, the patient-centered medical homes. You know, this is, you know, the call to action from the Surgeon General Report is really about including pharmacists on teams. And so really looking for models that continue to have pharmacists as members of those teams. So if the reimbursement is more at the practice level, like an accountable care organization, having them included in that practice, that's something that I think is an important consideration moving forward. And then again, continuing to look at opportunities for you know, changing the Social Security Act and having pharmacists formally recognized as providers, because that was an ongoing barrier that we saw across the sites.
Great, thank you.
Are there any additional questions from the audience? Well, thank you. If you want to have more discussions afterwards, that's fine. And thank you for coming. It was a great set of talks and interesting information. Thanks again.